I'm going to discuss a number of situations in which linear waves can become trapped by some solitons. So I need to sort of explain that a little bit. So what I'm thinking about is solitons are somehow self-consistent excitations of some nonlinear PDE, right, some nonlinear field. So what I need to have going on is I need to have some linear wave equation that's somehow coupled to the nonlinear problem. So the nonlinear problem will, in some sense, produce a potential, and the linear waves will propagate in that potential. And so under certain circumstances and when there's enough properties present in the nonlinear field, the linear waves can enjoy certain nice symmetry properties. So I'm going to discuss these things today. And throughout, the work that I will discuss is joint work with a number of people, James Besley and Neil Akhmediev from the Australian National University, Simon Clark from Monash University, and then I've also, of course, worked with Michael Weinstein and Avi Sofer. And I should also remember Peter Christiansen from the Technical University of Denmark. Okay. So the first, I want to start off kind of with an application, and this is the application I have in mind. So thinking about the propagation of light in what we call a planar waveguide, which is this thing over here. So it's a slab, a two-dimensional slab of transparent optical material in which, by some design, we can change the refractive index in this material to specifications. So the idea here is that the darker blue regions are supposed to be places where the refractive index is higher, and the lighter blue regions, the refractive index is lower. And then the sort of fundamental principle of optics is that the light wants to be where the refractive index is higher. Okay, so the idea is that this X shape and this Y shape and this little guy over here should function somehow as channels for the light, and so we can imagine creating some wires in this two-dimensional optical slab here, this planar waveguide, through which we guide the light. So this kind of picture on the left is what we might think of as something called an X junction. It's a way to bring two channels together and have two channels coming out on the output side. So I'm thinking of this part as the input and this part up here as the output. This is a, what kind of junction would this be if that's an X junction? This would be a Y junction. Yeah, so here's some kind of way to split optical power into from one input port into two output ports. And this guy over here, this is a sort of periodic looking structure which could have a number of purposes, but maybe could be used to tune the frequency of incoming light to a particular frequency at the output, so a kind of spectral filter. So if we're going to describe this mathematically, we want to describe the propagation of light in such a structure mathematically, the typical place that we might turn is to the paraxial approximation. In other words, we're thinking of light that's primarily propagating in this forward z direction here, and when we neglect the backward propagation of light waves in Maxwell's equations, it's not too hard to obtain as a formal approximation this Schrodinger equation right here to describe the propagation of the stationary envelope F of the electric field, so that's the unknown in the problem, in the presence of some distribution of refractive index, which is a function of X and Z, and that's this delta. Okay, so that's something that you put into the problem based on how you've designed the slab, and then the idea is to work out the propagation of this F. Or, if you like, you can think of it the other way around. Given what you would like to have for the propagation of F, how should you put down this delta? Okay, so you can think of it that way as well. When you derive this equation for Maxwell's equations, you have to fix some kind of a frequency for the carrier wave, and that frequency ends up inside of this beta parameter that you see in these two places here. So that will play some role in what follows. Okay, so what I'd like to now do is tell you about some special choices of this delta of X and Z that are very nice and make some connection with a nonlinear problem. Okay, so let's first of all, let's set this beta equals to 1 just to fix a value of it. And I want to do some algebra first. So let's start out with some expressions. So this A, what is this A? It's a polynomial in some parameter lambda of degree capital M. So I'm picking, I guess, a constant capital M, and I'm going to pick another constant capital N over here before I even start. And then I have a polynomial in lambda, in this parameter lambda, which I haven't told you much about, but anyway, this parameter lambda of degree capital M multiplied by an exponential in x and z. And then over here, this vector b, which has n components in it, that's this other number n, this vector b is just a polynomial of degree capital M minus 1 in the parameter lambda. And the coefficients in this expression and this expression are something I haven't mentioned yet because we're about to figure out what they are, okay? So the way you find out what they are is by the following algorithm. So this is the algebra part. So you choose M complex numbers in the upper half plane, lambda 1 through lambda M, and you also choose capital M vectors in Cn. Okay, so that's G1 through Gm. And what we do is impose a number of conditions on these two expressions. So if you evaluate the A at lambda k, that's the same thing as the kth G vector dagger, or conjugate transpose, times the expression B evaluated at the lambda k. And at the same time, if you evaluate the B vector at the complex conjugate of that lambda, that's minus A evaluated at the complex conjugate times the vector Gk. All right, so this is a whole bunch of constraints that you put on these expressions, and the point is that if you do that and you write these constraints out, what you see is that you have a square, inhomogeneous, linear system for these APs and for these BPs, or the entries of these vectors BP, and this is a problem with a determinant that you can evaluate explicitly, and it's not zero, so you can solve for those quantities, okay? It's just algebra. So the point is that having put these conditions down, you know completely these two expressions. So this has been some algebra. So now I'm going to get a refractive index function from that. And the way I do it is I just take the coefficient of the highest power in this B vector, and I take its squared norm and multiply by 4. Okay, so that's going to be some positive function of x and z at the end of the day. So the point here... The point here is that having picked this delta, now I get a whole bunch for free. I get a whole bunch of exact solutions of the Schrödinger equation, of the linear Schrödinger equation, and they're given by this formula here. So the key thing really is that this A up here, satisfies the Schrödinger equation no matter what lambda is. Lambda is an arbitrary complex parameter, and for any lambda whatsoever, this satisfies the Schrödinger equation, where this is the potential function. So in particular, if you consider lambda to be real and you normalize in this way, this is some convenient normalization, then this is some kind of dispersive mode. I'll explain more about that shortly. And over here, if you take the A and you evaluate it at the complex conjugates, is convenient, it turns out, of those lambdas, this is a finite set of functions, and if you want, you can apply the Gram-Schmidt procedure to them in L2, and these are exact solutions of the Schrödinger equation with this if you like, x and z dependent potential, which are bound states, so they decay for large x. All right, so that's kind of a procedure. Where does that procedure come from? I told you at the beginning that there's always some nonlinear problem which is building this potential function. And in this case, the nonlinear problem is this one. So it's a multiple component version of the focusing nonlinear Schrödinger equation. And then the idea is that if you take that vector B and you look at its highest coefficient and multiply by 2i, these are the entries of a solution of this problem, I should say. Okay, and it's one of these multi-soliton solutions. So I told you some formulas for some solutions of the linear Schrödinger equation with that formula for the delta, for the potential function. Yeah.
What is the physical relevance
of this
equation?
Of this one here. Well, there's a number of ways in which you can think of this one. So the easiest one is if capital N is 2, so then there's 2 entries here. This is a model. It's not the right model, but it's a model for propagation in optical fibers with 2 polarizations that are orthogonal. Okay? It's not the right model because the coefficients aren't quite right here. But anyway. But, you know, the way I'm thinking about this is that is I don't really care about the physical significance of this problem, because I'm thinking of what I showed you on the previous slide as a machine, kind of algebra machine, to generate interesting potential functions for which we can then study the linear Schrodinger equation. Okay? So what I'd like to now point out is that we know that those functions, the dispersive mode function and those bound state modes that I told you about, so this is the dispersive mode formula and this is the set of bound state modes that we wrote down on the previous page, these actually form an orthonormal basis of L2 for any fixed value of z. So that means that there's some expansion formulas like this. So any L2 function can be written in terms of the bound states and in terms of these dispersive modes. And the way that you get the coefficients in this kind of generalized Fourier-type expansion is by just taking inner products. Okay? So this is like the nicest possible situation you could be in. But this, you should keep in mind, is a complicated x and z-dependent potential in this problem. Okay? It's not a simple stationary potential. Just to make the point more, if we're going to solve the initial value problem in this special case when we've nailed this parameter beta to be 1, it doesn't have to be 1, but just some fixed value where we make this, do this analysis, then to solve this problem, given initial data, right, we have this thing, this function delta specified by some discrete data, so these complex numbers lambda 1 through lambda m and some corresponding vectors here. And we do that algebra, and that's how we get this delta. So what you do is you project your initial data orthogonally onto the basis element, this dispersive mode function and these bound states at z equals 0. Then you fix those expansion coefficients as constants, and the basis elements themselves have, if you like, time dependence in them. It's really z is the propagation variable in this problem, so they depend on z explicitly, and that's where the evolution comes from. And then at a later time, if you want to know what the answer is, you just use the completeness relation to sum up and figure out what f is. Okay, so it's just the usual kind of separation of variables formula, but in this more complicated context with some different potentials. Okay. So here's some special cases that are nice to think about. So let these lambdas be split into real and imaginary parts. So if the real parts are all distinct, then it turns out that this calculation can show you that this delta, this refractive index profile or potential function, splits up as z goes to plus or minus infinity into a bunch of hyperbolic secant squared shapes that are moving out at some angles depending on these sigmas and with amplitudes or depths of these potential wells depending on the imaginary parts. So this is like, you know, coming from solitons, right? I mean, I said that there was this nonlinear problem in the background, and these are just the individual solitons somehow separating from each other in the potential function. And on the other hand, superpositions of these bound state modes, remember it's a linear problem we're solving, so these things can be superposed, and superpositions of these guys turn out to have a similar asymptotic form. There shouldn't be a square there. That's fine. So just hyperbolic secant here, and then with some arbitrary coefficients. Okay. Now the point is that this is a linear problem. The Schrodinger equation is a linear problem. So what it means is that the UK minuses or UK pluses, let me say, which determine the asymptotic behavior of how much of this f is trapped in each one of these potential wells as z goes to plus infinity. These things are just linearly related to the UK minuses, which are the how much was in each potential well at minus infinity. So this is the linear relationship here, and the point is that this is explicitly computable in terms of these lambda k's. So that's one of the nice features of these magic potential functions. So for example, if there's only two of these channels that are crossing each other, then this is the matrix Tij that is in this formula here. It's exactly given by this guy here. So this was done with Niall Akhmediev. So right. So there are bound states and there's a dispersive continuum, but they don't talk to each other at all. Once we, of course, these formulas are not the usual Fourier type formulas, right? But these modes, once we've isolated them, don't talk to each other at all. They will when we perturb the problem, but that's coming later.
What is
complex conjugation, yeah. So here's a formula. Now, this is a great formula because you can look at that and say, now, what would I like to be true about this matrix Tij to design some optical device? And okay, then that tells me what I can do with these lambdas. All right. So here's an example of that. No, before I do that, let me say some more. So in optics, we're more interested in power than anything else. So we're more interested in power than other quantities. So that's just an integral of the square of the norm, a square of the absolute value of the field. So for a hyperbolic secant-shaped beam, this thing turns out to be proportional to the absolute value squareds of these coefficients uk plus and minus, multiplied by this rho k, which is, if you like, is the depth of the potential well in which the pulse is riding. So that means that if you're going to compute the transfer of power, of optical power, you don't want the Tij matrix. You want the absolute value squareds of the matrix elements with this prefactor. Okay, so this is like a power transfer matrix. So for two channels, for example, from that previous formula that I had on the slide, if you assume that the rho I and the rho j are the same, so that means that the two channels have the same depth, the only parameter involved is what's the angle at which they cross each other. So then the exact formula for the P matrix is just this guy right here, and this delta in this formula is just the difference between the two real parts of those lambdas. So this is like a velocity or angle difference. So, for example, if delta is close to zero, so the channels are almost parallel to each other, then there's a complete exchange of power. On the other hand, if delta is going to infinity, which amounts to one of these channels sort of becoming horizontal, then there's no crosstalk at all. So, of course, you can tune between the two cases. So here's an example. Okay. So here is an example where I wanted to design one of these things where the output, where the an arbitrary input was split 50-50 by power into the output arms. So on the left here is the shape of the actual, this is like a graph or some kind of density plot of the refractive index function, which looks like a collision of two solitons somehow. But anyway, this is a solution of the Schrodinger equation with this as the potential function. It's one of the solutions. So you see that, you know, you can have an excitation in one of the input arms with nothing over here, and it turns out it's split exactly 50-50 into the two output arms. And there's no radiative losses of any sort coming from this junction. So it's a perfect, at the level of the Schrodinger paraxial type approximation for optics, this is a perfect splitter. Okay, of power. Okay, all right. So you could also, if you like, you can do other things. So if you want, you can consider this refractive index function to be minus the sum of squares of some fields, where the fields satisfy a defocusing multiple component nonlinear Schrodinger equation. So the answer of how the propagation happens and how the linear propagation happens in this case is sort of simpler and maybe more useful. So what turns out to be true is that no matter what you do with the angles of these channels or their depths, no matter what you do, there's always zero crosstalk whatsoever between the two channels. This is an exact calculation that one does from the, I haven't shown you the math behind this, but from similar calculations to what we were talking about earlier for this focusing version of this problem, it turns out that there's no crosstalk whatsoever. So the white channel temporarily mixes in here but ends up all coming out at the top, and the yellow one passes through this way. Okay. So this would be good, for example, for creating very dense optical circuitry, right? You could, if you just wanted to cross a bunch of channels and have them occupy the same layer without talking to each other, the idea is you should make all the junctions look roughly like this, where this is some potential function, that some refractive index profile, which is derived from this nonlinear problem here. Okay, you could avoid the crosstalk of the channels. Okay, right. Now, so far we've had all of the lambdas having distinct real parts, and this makes all the channels sort of move at some angles with respect to each other. But if some of these lambdas have the same real part, then there's kind of two possibilities. So the first possibility is that the corresponding vectors, the GKs, are mutually orthogonal to each other, and this requires that we have enough components in our nonlinear field. But anyway, if this is true, then it turns out that that the channels in this problem, if you like, they superpose in some screwy way to form what, so Akhmediev and Sukharukov refer to this object as a multi-soliton complex. So if you look at the refractive index function as a function of x and z, it's something with a very complicated cross-sectional profile, but it just propagates at some angle without change of form whatsoever. So this is like a multimoded waveguide, if you like. It's a multimoded channel type waveguide. On the other hand, somehow the more usual situation is that you choose these vectors GK not to be orthogonal to each other. So if you have only one component, like in your nonlinear field, this has to be the case. And in this case, the channels interfere with each other in a quasi-periodic fashion, and so you get this kind of quasi-periodic type behavior of your refractive index profile. So so some sort of pictures of that. Okay, so this is a case where I'm going to consider these lambdas to have the same real part. In fact, I guess they're all zero in this particular, in these pictures here. So it turns out that in this case, the bound states of the problem, all of the bound states, remember that there's as many of them as there are lambdas, okay? So these things turn out to be exact independent Floquet solutions of the linear Schrodinger equation with z periodic coefficients in this particular case. So not only that, but I should mention that these guys all have exactly the same Floquet multiplier. So they're independent, they're linearly independent, but they have the same Floquet multiplier. Okay? So first of all, this is rather unexpected because it's a periodic Schrodinger equation with bound states. As many of them as you want, in fact. That's the first kind of strange thing here. But, I mean, these are quite special potentials, so there's some hope here. But anyway, on the other hand, the interesting thing is that because these Floquet exponents are exactly the same, or the multipliers are the same, you can have superpositions of odd and even modes, say, if you have symmetry. So here's an example of one of these waveguides that's a periodic type structure. If you want to look at pictures of the even mode and the odd modes, they look something like this. But the point is these guys have the same Floquet multiplier, so you can superpose them and you get another periodic solution without symmetry. Okay, so I don't really know how to explain this, but I'm just thinking that there's some potential well that's oscillating around like this, and somehow the quantum particle starts to roll down in the middle, and then when it gets pushed back up, it goes back the same way. I'm not really sure what to say, but this is what the solutions look like, okay? So, all right. So now, I'd like to mention something about perturbation theory. So if we have these exact solutions of the linear Schrodinger equation for some of these complicated potential functions, one thing that you could do is say, well, I'm interested in more general potential functions than these. So what happens if we perturb the problem, if we change the potential a little bit? Or maybe from the optical perspective, something that's also interesting to do is to vary the frequency of the carrier wave, which amounts to perturbing away from the beta equals one scenario. So we have exact modal decomposition for beta equals 1, so when beta is 1 plus epsilon, and epsilon is a small number, we could try to treat the problem perturbatively in this modal basis. So we've already heard some talks about this today. I'll just summarize in some pictures here. So the first thing is that as a first-order effect in this parameter epsilon, one finds beating between the modes. So I said that when epsilon is 0, they have the same... these modes have the same Floquet multiplier, but this is not true when you change epsilon. You turn the epsilon on, and the first thing that happens to those multipliers is that they move apart from each other. They stay on the unit circle, but they move apart from each other. And this amounts to a kind of modal beating when we consider superpositions. So this is what you see in the picture. The particle spends some time on one side of the well, and then it slowly diffuses to the other side and back again and so on. But you see the little oscillations here is the actual period of the structure, the period of the motion of the potential well. But then, as we heard this morning, the second order effect in this parameter epsilon, one experiences radiative decay. So the bound states begin to transfer energy to the continuous spectrum, and so the even mode will decay, as will the odd one, with some decay constants that can be calculated. And so that was the calculation of the decay constants was done in this paper, and in this paper we calculated the perturbation, first order perturbation result here. Okay. So all right. So that's been a little story about some, if you like, time dependent Schrödinger equations with special potentials for which one can solve the problem exactly and maybe even engineer the potential to have some nice properties. So I want to tell you about another problem, which is quite different but has some similar flavor to it. So here's a mechanical model that I'm going to lay on you here. So what do we have? We have some blocks that I want to think of as being quite heavy and that are connected with some rather stiff springs like this. And then on each block, there's a little frictionless track that's mounted in these transverse directions. And there are tiny masses, little m here, that are sitting in these frictionless tracks and are connected by some softer springs. Okay, so these are allowed to move up and down, and these larger blocks can move left and right. So if we let we think of u sub n as the displacement to the right from equilibrium of the nth block, and we think of v sub n as the displacement from some equilibrium horizontal or equilibrium vertical position of the nth little mass here, then we can write down a Hamiltonian for this in terms of two potential functions for the two kinds of springs. So the kinetic energy is just the sum of the two types of kinetic energy arising from the two different types of motion. And then the potential energy, well, there's a contribution here coming from the stiff springs and the motion of the blocks. That's just this guy. L is the equilibrium distance between the blocks. And then there's a part coming from these other springs up here, and that's this contribution here. And you have this Pythagorean business coming in because, after all, these things can be moving up and down, so there could be some angles to these springs, right? So this is a Hamiltonian, and then we might try to analyze this problem. So let's look at a continuum limit. So let's assume that the little masses are a small fraction of the total mass of the little guy and the blocks. All right, the capital M is the total of those two. So M is a mu is a small parameter, and the V, which is the spring energy, if you like, of the transverse motion. This is a small multiple of the spring energy of the backbone. So that's another way of saying that one has stiff springs on the backbone and relatively soft ones for the transverse energy, transverse motion. And then we want to make a small amplitude long wave on such. So we have another small parameter h, and we say that the displacement of the nth displacement in the backbone is h times some smooth function u of capital X and capital T, where those capital X and capital T are h times n and h times the ordinary t, and a similar assumption for the vertical displacements of the particles in the tracks. So if you do this and you start to push things through, what you find is that because of this small amplitude assumption, you have some sort of dominant linear dynamics for this problem. And the dominant linear dynamics has a group velocity associated with the backbone and a group velocity associated with the transverse motion. And unless these two match up, nothing interesting happens in the problem. So let's assume that they match up. That amounts to some sort of condition like this. The W and the U, remember, are the potential functions for the two types of springs, and we're evaluating them at the equilibrium displacement. So this is a kind of matching condition, and if you do that, then this is the formula that comes out for the common group velocity of those two types of waves. So now they're traveling in the same speed, and so one can change to a traveling frame with that speed and rescale the variables x and t. So now you take a formal limit, h going to 0, and the mu parameter up here, that's the relative scaling of the masses and the potentials, is much smaller than h squared. And if you do that, you arrive formally at this family of these two coupled equations here. So A is something related to the motion of the backbone, and B is something related to the motion of the transverse motion of the little particles in the tracks. Okay, and there's a coupling constant kappa that's coming into the B equation. So these are the two. This one is a nonlinear equation for A, and this one is a linear equation for the B, but it has the A in it. Okay. All right. So, so the first observation that I want to make here is that the A equation is the Korteweg-de-Vries equation, right? This is the KdV equation. This is some linear equation that's coupled to the KdV equation by this term here, which has this constant, this coupling constant kappa in it. So, okay, so there are going to be some cases where treating this linear equation over here is something that we can handle, just like we could handle the linear Schrodinger equation with these magical potentials in them as long as beta was equal to 1, right? And then otherwise we're perturbing around that special case. So likewise, there are going to be some special kappas where we can make progress with this one. So the first example is kappa equals 1. So if you put kappa equals 1 here, then this equation over on the right-hand side is just the linearization of the KdV equation around the solution A, okay? So in that case, because this is a translation invariant equation, one can get a very simple non-trivial solution of this problem just by taking a derivative with respect to x, right? So this function here is, if you like, the simplest non-trivial solution of this equation that we just get for free once we know what the A is, okay, if kappa is 1. More generally, one can find particular solutions in terms of squared eigenfunctions. I'll say something more about that shortly, but it's something related to the integrability of the Korteweg-de-Vries equation. So in other words, there is some family of particular solutions for the B equation as long as A satisfies KdV and as long as kappa is 1, and that's these guys. But not only is this a family of particular solutions, but there are enough of them to go around, so one can solve the initial value problem for the B equation with those solutions by superposition. That was proved by Sachs in 83. So these squared eigenfunctions form a basis. Okay. All right. So on the other hand, you could also look at another case. You could look at kappa is equal to 1/2. So you put 1/2 here. So suddenly, this equation on the right-hand side, this is not anymore the linearization of the KdV equation about any solution of the KdV equation, right? It's a different thing. On the other hand, we can easily eyeball a very simple non-trivial solution if kappa is 1/2. We should just set B equals A, right? So that gives you one solution for free. Of course, you'd like to know that there's more solutions than just this one, just like there are in this case, and you'd like to know some sort of completeness. Anyway, we'll go on and say more about that shortly. But first, let me show you what happens for the other kappas. Okay. So there's a sort of parametric instability in this problem. And so one thing that one can do is one can pick as a special solution of the KdV equation just this one soliton solution. So this is some bump-shaped particle propagating along, or solution propagating along, with a single parameter eta, which is related to the soliton eigenvalue for this problem. And so the idea here is to make an ansatz for B, which is related to this. In other words, I'd like to think that what the solution of the B equation is some function that propagates in the same frame of reference as the soliton, and which has some growth rate attached to it, some growing factor. And I'd like to figure out what these sigmas are, because if I know what the sigmas are, well, in particular, if sigma is purely imaginary, then this is going to be some kind of a bound state, something that will be trapped by the soliton. And if sigma has a real part, then what we have is some kind of resonant amplification. So, okay, so this leads to a third order eigenvalue problem for this B sigma, which is parametrized by the coupling kappa. So sigma is the eigenvalue. So, okay, so with Simon Clark, we computed these eigenvalues, these sigmas, numerically, as a function of kappa. And here you can see a picture. This is the real part of eigenvalues, sigma, as a function of increasing kappa, and here's the imaginary part as a function of increasing kappa. And you see a number of curves here. There's a solid curve and a dashed one and a dotted dashed and so on and so on. These are just different branches, different eigenvalues, okay, different sigmas. So so the main thing that I'd like to point out in this picture is that is that all these curves, once they're generated, like here's a curve that's generated from this point, it doesn't actually come back down to zero. It looks like it does in the picture, but that's just because you're sitting where you are. It actually decays rather slowly down to the zero, down to the axis here. And so what it means is that except for this value here, which is kappa equals a half, and this value here, which is kappa equals one, there is always an eigenvalue with a real part. Okay? So for all kappas, in particular, all kappas bigger than one, there's always a real part present. And so the only possible values of kappa for which one could expect to have some wave that's stably trapped by the soliton is these two. So that's a numerical result. Okay. So some solution formulas. So when you study the KdV equation, you study this lax pair here. So this is a kind of compatible. This is the KdV equation itself for A of x and t is the compatibility condition between this ordinary differential equation, linear ordinary differential equation in x, and this linear ordinary differential equation. This linear equation in x and t. Okay. So one can just compute that by compatibility. A of x and t solves KdV. So what one does is the following. So let's take an arbitrary complex lambda, and let's define B of x and t by this formula. So take the simultaneous solution f of these two problems here, multiply by this trivial exponential factor, and take an x derivative. So it's elementary to show from here that this thing satisfies the B equation when kappa is equal to a half. Okay, and it has an arbitrary parameter lambda in it coming in from the f and coming from this factor, so you could start to hope that maybe there's a lot of these things. All right, so this is in contrast to what happens when kappa is 1. I told you that there are these squared eigenfunction solutions. So what the formula that holds when kappa is 1 is that b of xt, the analog of this formula, is b of xt is d by dx of f squared. Okay. So these are linear forms in the eigenfunction instead of quadratic forms. All right. So so I'd like to talk about solitons. So there's this procedure of Kay and Moses from 1956 for reflectionless potentials of the stationary Schrodinger equation, which is the following idea. So we consider an expression of this sort. So f of xt and lambda is a Laurent polynomial in lambda with some unknown coefficients times an exponential. And then you pick some positive eta's, eta 1 through eta n, and some real alphas, and you impose linear conditions of this sort on this expression. And as I told you before, in the nonlinear Schrodinger case, it turns out that these conditions here for n goes from 1 up to capital N make a square inhomogeneous linear system for these fn of x and t's. And this system is invertible. So this is algebra, again, to determine the fn of x and t's from these numbers and from these numbers. And once you've done that, it turns out that the function a of xt, which is 6i times this x derivative of the top coefficient of f, this thing is a function of x and t, and it solves the KdV equation. It's an n-soliton solution of the KdV equation. So it looks like this. As t goes to plus and minus infinity, it breaks up into isolated pulses. And then these two f functions with lambda being plus or minus, these are linearly independent solutions of the lax pair. So it's these kind of functions from which we can construct solutions of the B equation. So that's this one. So here's kind of a result. So let's take these functions f plus and minus and multiply by the exponential factor. So this is the guy that if I take an x derivative of it, this is going to solve the B equation. So let's do that. So this is a function h plus and minus of xt and a parameter lambda that for every lambda and for either plus or minus, this solves the B equation. So we invent a mode function, h of x and lambda, which is just this thing multiplied by a factor. This is an entire function of lambda. And then let's take a function phi of x, which is an L1 and should be absolutely continuous. So from this function phi, we can construct these integrals involving this function g plus, which is this guy. So this gives us some sort of amplitudes, b plus and minus of lambda, some integral transforms of this function phi of x, which I'm thinking of as initial data for the b equation. And then b of lambda is b plus plus b minus, and b zero is a half the residue of the difference at lambda equals zero. These have a singularity at lambda equals zero. And bn plus or minus is minus plus the residue at the other poles, okay? So that's given by these formulas here. So these are like discrete mode amplitudes. Here's the expansion. So phi of x is given by the singular integral involving this amplitude b of lambda times the mode function, plus a contribution at lambda equals zero, and then contributions at all of these eta n's, okay, or 2i eta n minus 2i eta n. These are discrete mode type contributions. So this is a way of taking a function phi and writing it as a superposition of this mode function for different values of lambda, okay? So this is a completeness relation, and it's the tool that we need in order to solve the B equation. So some remarks. So we have a representation of phi in terms of a sum of discrete components like bound states and a singular integral over a continuous spectrum. The mapping between the function and its expansion coefficients is rather asymmetrical, so it's not just a matter of taking inner products and projecting. The formulas for going one way are different from the formulas for going the other way. And so the main ideas of the proof, well, there's an ODE, it's in X, that's satisfied by these G functions, so that's this guy here. And the idea is I'd like to solve this, I'd like to find the resolvent for this problem. The trouble is that I have an operator over here, which I can't invert with this lambda. But anyway, I can still solve this equation by variation of parameters, and I can take the expression that solves the equation, and I can call it a resolvent, and I can integrate it over some large semicircular contours in the lambda plane. And from looking at that object, I can then directly prove that this object converges to the identity operator. So that's a direct proof. And you use some analogies with Fourier expansion that appear in these formulas. These are explicit formulas for large lambda. So that's the basic strategy of the proof. So to solve the initial value problem, when you're at kappa is a half, you start out with an n-soliton solution of KdV. You project the initial data onto the modes using those expansion formulas. Then you fix the expansion coefficients, and the mode function itself evolves in time in an explicit fashion. So then later on, you recover the B of X and T by just adding up the results of this evolution and the coefficients that you found in step one by the completeness relation. Okay. So that's how to handle the B equation when kappa is a half, and as I said, when kappa is one, Sachs showed how to handle that case by adding up squared eigenfunctions. All right, so again, a kind of thing to get your mind on is what happens when you have bound states for kappa equals a half. So the A function for n-soliton formula looks something like this. When t goes to plus and minus infinity, it's some kind of potential Wells again. And so it turns out that the B function, if you add up only the bound state modes, it also looks quite similar with some coefficients beta n plus and minus. And it's a linear equation for B, so there's a linear relationship between the beta pluses and the beta minuses with some transfer matrix, TJK. And again, this is something that one can compute explicitly just from knowledge of the bound states and the way that they depend algebraically on the parameters. So it turns out the matrix elements only depend on the parameters, the eta n's that you have to pick. And for example, when n is 2, there's a formula exactly like this for this transfer matrix, this TJK. The thing to notice here that's interesting, I'll show you on the next slide why, is this minus sign in the 2-2 entry. This is a negative quantity, turns out, because the eta 1 is always bigger than eta 2. The eta's are like actually they're the energy levels in the Schrodinger operator for the KdV equation. So they're the eigenvalues.
When you, in your construction.
Oh yeah, the lambdas were the singularities are on the imaginary axis. So I guess lambda is like I lambda. Yeah. Okay. So remember that 2-2 matrix entry is negative. Always negative. So what does that mean? Well, here's some some simulation, numerical simulation of this coupled problem, kappa is a half. So the top picture is the solution of KdV. So here's two solitons, before and after an interaction. We know that the big ones travel faster to the right than the small ones, so this one overtakes that one, and here's the picture later on. Okay. So now I want to solve the B equation. So here's a solution of the B equation, which is a bound state that initially, for t goes to minus infinity, is confined to this potential well here. There's nothing over here. And so we just follow this through the interaction, and we see that after a while, its energy is shared between the two potential wells. Okay. If we put something in this potential well and we allow it to propagate through, we again get something in each potential well, but you notice that the one that comes out in the slow soliton is a negative. It's a wave of depression is what the water wave people would call it, instead of a wave of elevation. And so this is a direct consequence of T22 being less than zero. Okay. So, all right. So I just want to conclude to say that so linear wave equations that are parametrically driven by solutions of nonlinear integrable equations can arise in physical systems in a number of ways, but we saw kind of two ways here. By fortune, might be the last, the KdV type example. Here we started with some mechanical problem, we did some asymptotics, we got some equations, and we saw that this kind of structure appeared. But you can also do it by design. You could imagine, thinking of the optical problem, that you would like to design a refractive index profile that does something that you want, and so you can use nonlinearity to help you out with that. Integrable structure can be exploited to provide general solutions to these linear equations in the form of some generalized transforms. The waves can be trapped by solitons under certain circumstances, and their mechanics can be calculated, including interactions among the trapping solitons. And then a key point here, especially in regard to the conference today, is that the integrable machinery is a useful starting point for perturbation theory. So one can start with this modal decomposition and use these as the right coordinates with which to study problems that are not exactly integrable, that don't have just the right structure, but are somehow nearby. Okay? All right. Thank you very much. Yeah, well, right. So when you derive the paraxial wave equation from the Maxwell equation, you're forgetting about the backward propagating wave. And once you have any, z dependence or time dependence in the Maxwell picture, in your profile, you're going to generate reflections, backward reflections, right? So it's at this time when you sort of, the whole derivation of this equation is quite formal, right? But it's a multiple scale type process, right? So the scale of the electric field, the envelope of the electric field, and also the scale of the structure should both be very long compared with wavelengths, right?
Yeah, but you have a complete example for the delta x and z. How does that scale?
So what you do, right, is you take that example. Right, you write down some delta of x and z, and you want to translate back to the physical world, right? But then you have to remember how you derived this equation. There's some epsilon, which is the scale ratio, which is going to zero. The smaller that number is, the better the approximation of Maxwell by Schrodinger is. Okay, so you put that epsilon in, you get a potential, you get some refractive index profile, some propagation model in the Maxwell equations. How accurate that is depends on how small the epsilon is. What this epsilon is doing is it's, of course, smearing out the profile. It's making it broader, more slowly varying, okay, and more shallow, as a matter of fact. So, that's the way you do it. You pick your profile, and then if you tune this epsilon parameter small enough that your reflections are negligible. Yeah, yeah. For that frequency, yeah.
Frequency. Is the analogous problem if you take
slightly different group speeds for the coupled
transverse? Yeah, the analogous problem would be to take, so yeah, the coupling constant kappa involves the potential functions, and of course is related, and so does the group speed. So I think if you varied if you allowed there to be some bifurcations and splitting of the two group velocities, that amounts to changing the kappa. Yeah. And there's lots of ways to change the kappa, but that's one way. Yeah.
Maybe you said it, but I didn't get it. What is the relation between optical and mechanical parts of the electron?
It's just that at the end there's sort of a similar mathematical theme, right? Which is that there's a linear equation with a non-constant coefficient in it, and the non-constant coefficient can be thought of usefully as coming from a non-linear problem.
What kind of physical applications is this mechanical spring model?
Well, I mean, there are of course lots of applications of like mechanical chains with internal degrees of freedom. So an example is like the dynamics of long chain type proteins, for example, right? So these things have a backbone structure which is known to have some rather slow frequencies of motion, but there are internal degrees of freedom in the amino acids along the chain which have very high frequencies of motion and sometimes are depends on the orientations but can be transverse. So I mean, but I would like to make no claim that this particular model that I wrote down is of any physical significance, but you know. But there are problems that are like that.